Welcome to the Hay Matters podcast, brought to you by Local Ag and Feed Central. This is your go-to source for all things hay-related in Australia. I'm your host, John Paul Driver. In today's episode, we're joined by Matt Eckert. Matt farms in South Australia, east of Adelaide, and the nearest recognizable town would be Meningi. I had the good fortune to be able to visit Matt and his brother Tim a couple of years ago when I was touring around.
G'day, John. Thanks for having me.
I have very fond memories of visiting, a shop that would make anybody turn green with envy. Very well laid out, well equipped, and just truly well thought out. I am envious. And then some of your local growing conditions, maybe we can talk about that, are mind-boggling to me. I very distinctly remember stories of your grandfather clearing land and the undercutter that you still have, the piles of sticks that tells the stories of years and years of work building a farm. Just one of my favorite stops when I was in Australia.
Glad you enjoyed it, John.
Oh, I did. One of the questions I wanted to ask about is Lucerne. Obviously, it's deep-rooted. I mean, they say, I'm having to do the metric conversion. 6 meters down is what the roots will go on a mature stand.
Yes, yeah, they'll go down a long way, that's for sure. And they hold on for the longest of any, but, you know, this dry spell certainly tested it, especially our young Lucerne, that's really struggled. Yeah, it just hasn't got its tap root down deep enough yet. Mm. So, yeah, it just thins it out and takes away, I guess, the ability for opportunities moving forward.
If you damage the young Lucerne, the stand is never the same again.
Yep, that's exactly right. So, I mean, it'll be okay. We'll go on with it, and because it will still provide quite good feed, mm-hmm. but we won't be, I don't think there'll be any opportunities for things like Lucerne hay and that off of it until we get around to sort of fixing it up. But we've just lost too much country over the last 2 years with a couple of tough springs, and we just need some time to get back around, I guess.
Consistent rains is is the answer to the problem.
It is, yeah. Yep.
Now, has that Lucerne been planted in the last year?
Yeah, so we just did 400 hectares of new renovation to Lucerne this last season, obviously. That was on, we plaza ploughed it. It's all bottomless sand, like beach sand.
Ah, yeah.
Non-wetting sand, so we plaza ploughed it. And, we sowed barley on it, and we ripped the barley, and then we sowed Lucerne into the stubble.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very surprising what is there today, but certainly struggling along, that's for sure.
My question there is, can you go back and interseed more Lucerne if it's been, the research says you don't get the autotoxicity issues until that 15 months after seeding. And if it's been drought stressed, maybe because I understand that the metacarpins that are the autotoxin, they don't form until the plants are a little more mature. And if they're drought stressed, maybe there's less metacarpin production.
Yeah.
We're exploring on the very edges of, in the most extreme conditions, right?
Yes. And I think if I was to do anything about it, I'd probably blow it out and sow it back to barley and then start again just for that.
Yeah.
Very hard to get loose and established when you're struggling on rains. It's just not enough moisture there to get the young stuff going. The stuff that is there won't let the young Lucerne get going.
Yeah.
So I'd probably spray it out, disc it back, sow barley on it, and
give it a year.
You get some instant cash flow back then, and then just start again and hope you're having a better run. But I mean, in saying that, John, in the last sort of, well over 10 years now, we haven't had a failure as far as re-establishing new Lucerne pastures. So, and I definitely wouldn't say this is a failure. It's just maybe not quite where we would like it. And 2006, that was the last year. We really struggled with new seeding Lucerne, just dry spring, late season, strong winds all year. That was the last time we probably actually failed a Lucerne establishment. So if you look at the big picture, we always talk about the game, we're playing the long game. So I guess in the end of the day, it's not really that bad.
To win 90% of the time is okay, But
that's exactly right.
But that 10%, that 1 year, doesn't feel really good.
Not when you're in it and you're living it every day. It certainly becomes challenging. Yeah. Yep.
You've already mentioned non-wetting sands. Tell me about some of the growing conditions.
Firstly, by just filling you in where we are, you said we're at Meningie, and Meningie is situated on the lower lakes in SA, so Lake Albert and Lake Alexandrina, and we're fortunate to farm right at the end of that mighty river system. My dad's homestead farm is on the Lake Alexandrina, right where the river ends, and we are very lucky to farm here. I think it's a beautiful area, but one of our massive challenges is obviously limestone rocks and into salt lakes and so on, and then moving down into our non-wetting sand country. And it's a huge challenge for us. It's a rewarding challenge, but non-wetting sand's a funny one. Like, you get that 20-30 mil of repellent sand on top and nothing will grow in it. It just won't wet up. The water will run off. It'll run to the hollows. It takes a lot to get it wet. And it's just one of those extreme challenges that we face in our local area. But with modern techniques now, with soil amelioration, deep ripping, prosa plowing, all that sort of stuff, we've worked out ways that we can handle it. And it's been extremely rewarding, the outcomes that we've achieved off of sands. And we're not in a huge rainfall area. We're about 400 mil annual rainfall, but we can stretch that rainfall a long way with some strategic management and things like that.
And does that, the timing of that rainfall, I know it's a particular concern right now, but normally would the timing of that rainfall occur in crop?
Yeah, normally, I mean, we're very fortunate here. We're fairly coastal, not far off the coastline there. And we get sort of rain, obviously November, December, January, February are normally our driest months. But other than that, we sort of normally get quite good rains throughout the entire season, and that's what keeps our sand going. It's we grow our crops and our pastures on 10 to 20 mil rain events, you know, throughout the year. You know, that consistent, reliable rainfall, not massive but reliable, is the key to us producing stuff.
Now let's talk a little bit about some of those soil amendments that you're making. You're actually adding rather large volumes of clay to that sand to increase your water penetration and retention, right?
Yeah, clay spreading's a massive part of our soil amelioration program here, and we've done hundreds and hundreds of acres of it. Obviously, the clay spreading is the permanent fix to our non-wetting sand issue, getting that wettable clay up and mixed through our non-wetting sand layer. That is the ultimate sort of fix to our problem, but it's the most expensive, it's the most time consuming, and you've got to be able to find it also. So on our northern side of our farm, where you would say we do a lot more cropping, we're sort of clay spreading all the sand in between our cropping country, simply because we can genuinely find the clay. As you head south, we head down into, you know, deeper sands. So, I mean, you can dig all you like out there. You're just not going to find clay. It's not there. We have rising salt water levels coming up from salinity from underneath. So, you know, all of those things there are, you know, add to the challenge. And when you can't find clay, you got to somehow come up with another way. And that's where our deep ripping and our plosa ploughing, inverting that sand, is a big game changer to what we do.
That ploughing that you're doing, how deep are you going? And on the deep ripping?
When we're deep ripping, we're running a terraline, Bednar terraline, and we're sort of ripping between 400 to 700 mil, you know, where it's good. We've done a bit of delving. You know, delving, you're going down, you know, down to a metre, but you bring up a lot of unwanted things when you start diving things in at a metre deep.
Oxide of mansion.
Oh, rocks, mate. They just float to the top. And huge amount of limestone, rubble limestone underneath this country. So just got to be extremely careful. I mean, we always say the Bednar and that, the biggest fault with them, they just don't lift quick enough. You hit the rocks and you just can't get them out the ground quick enough. So hence why we run the plosa ploughing system. It's built off of like the principles of a moldboard plough without, obviously a moldboard plough is way more efficient, but if we put a moldboard plough in the ground here, we'd hit the first rock and we'd be smashing plates and all sorts of things. Whereas the Proza plough sort of allows us to hydraulic jumps on it, jumps up over the rocks, rogs a few out, but yeah, leaves a lot behind too and doesn't destroy the machine. So that's why we've been running the Proza plough system.
All right. You've been doing this for several years. What is the outcome during the present drought? Can you tell the difference in the fields that you've done your soil amendments and different practices to? Or is the drought so severe that it really hasn't mattered?
Well, I think at the beginning, moving into the drought, we plus applied a new block. We purchased another farm, just adjoining farm down the road, and it was full of cooch and just a disaster, to be perfectly honest with you. And we thought, me and Tim thought we'd have a swing, which we did. And we knew purchasing it that the only way to make money off of this particular farm was to plus plough it. There was no other alternative. No tying machine would have gone through it. No ripping machine would have done it. It was solely, it had to be a disc, it had to be deep, it had to invert. It was back to the plaza plough. So we put two plaza ploughs onto it and we ploughed at 800 hectares worth it was. And I'd have to say it looked like a disaster. It was drifting, just blue and blue. It was all had sand hills and all sorts in it. So we had a land plane down there leveling it in. And I remember one of the guys we had driving one of our ploughs, he said to me and Tim, he said, yeah, you boys are in way too deep. You're in way too deep. We're ploughing down there in February and it's 38, 40 degrees and it's just a disaster. And we're like, no, we've done all these trials and we've been doing it for a lot of years now and we know it's the only option. And I guess I remember saying to him, I said, the only thing that will bugger us up is if we get a millennial drought. Well, we ploughed it, we swifted it three times and we had it beautiful and it wouldn't rain and it wouldn't rain. And we got 14 mil of rain. So we went down and we sowed it and then we had the 14 mil of rain on top of it. It come up and it looked brilliant all year, but the dry took its toll in the end. We ended up reaping 700 tonne of grain off of that block, which we thought was, I think that's about nearly about 800 tonne off of the block and 700 or 800 tonne, which considering we're in the millennial drought, I think was a pretty good result. Hadn't have ploughed that, hadn't the soil ameliorated it, hadn't put any of that working, we would have reaped absolutely nothing without a shadow of doubt. So I guess you could say, yes, we still... lost money. We didn't make much of it. Well, we didn't make any of a profit out of it, but we still produced 800 tonne of barley and we have a clean block. And we're down there sowing to canola right now. We sort of had most of it in before this 8 mil of rain fell. So we're on the front foot now. So getting back to your question there, John, at the end of the day, no plaza ploughing, no result. Absolute no brainer. Couldn't recommend it enough. We knew that when we were doing it. And I'm just so glad we tackled the whole thing when we did. So,
okay. Take me through some of your management strategies in this drought. What are you doing differently? What I hear you telling me is that you've prepared well for it. But what decisions are you making day to day, those tactical decisions in cropping or sowing? Where you're at, is it sowing, seeding, planting?
We're seeding at the moment.
Use seeding. Yeah. Okay. As you're seeding or as you're managing your livestock in this terrible drought, what are you doing differently?
So I guess with these tough times, we've, implemented a lot of what we've learned over the past, and dry seeding practices are obviously an outstanding way to sort of get off on the front foot quick when it does rain. So we've implemented a bit of dry seeding and stuff like that. We have some other issues though that have, I guess, come to the surface. Normally I would be a pretty confident dry seeding sort of character. The more in the better, really. It's a numbers game. But this year's obviously presented a few extra challenges that have made us maybe second guess our decisions. But one of them is, like, on our bean stubbles, we obviously use Reflex on our beans. And obviously the plant back there is, you know, you need quite a substantial amount of rain. And we've grazed our stubbles pretty hardly throughout this dry time, trying to keep the sheep off of our sandy soils. So we've lost our stubble retention. So, you know, there's an issue there with drift and stuff. So we're going to sow canola on those beans with that Reflex. Now, that's sort of a forbidden move, really, according to the label. But, I mean, at the end of the day, it will work. We've done trials, but it won't work if we have that, if the furrows fill in with contaminated soil. So we have to be extremely careful when we dry seed that. And that's why we waited for a little bit of rain.
So what you're talking about, just to make sure that I understand perfectly, is the herbicide residuals in the soil that normally would not be a problem because a normal rainfall would allow the biological activity to metabolize those herbicides or to move that herbicide a little farther down into the soil profile where it's not as harmful, or a combination of both, right?
Exactly, John, and that's why we don't want that sand drifting into our furrows on top of our canola seed. So just waited on it. We'll probably take a little bit of a yield penalty because of maybe not being in quick, but at the end of the day, I would rather a good germination rate and no Reflex damage if we can avoid that. So we've sort of held back on the rains a little bit there. We've been down sowed. Anything that's been soil ameliorated, we've certainly dry seeded all of our oats and rolled them all down. They're all ready to go. So yeah, we're onto our canola now. Have most of our canola in by the end of the week, and then it'll be onto our cereals, our wheat and barley. So yeah, it's other thing we've been doing is over sowing our looser pastures. We just waited for rain to start with that, and so we got the second seeder doing that at the moment. And so we'll get through it pretty quick. Within 2 weeks, we'll be shutting the book on our seeding program pretty well.
It's so fascinating to me because we've just finished seeding. Truthfully, I have just a little bit of lucerne left to seed. The timing that we're on opposite sides of the world, opposite seasons, and sowing at almost the exact same time is fascinating to me. And you're a little delayed, right?
Yeah, I would say we're delayed. The optimum time for us, I mean, we love to be sort of starting around that Anzac Day is traditionally is just a really nice time to start, I believe. And so, yeah, we're a little bit behind schedule, but I'm not too concerned, John. I haven't changed the program too much. I've just made some strategic moves, like we're saying about the herbicide issues, things like that. Our biggest, you know, our cropping enterprise is probably the least of my worries, actually, John. It's, you know, when it rains, it'll be okay. Things will recover. We've got things pretty set up pretty well. We've got good systems in place, good seeding principles and all of that sort of stuff. It's just the livestock side's what's really challenged us over the last sort of, well, basically 2 years now, definitely the last 18 months and certainly the last sort of, you know, 4 to 5 months. That's where a lot of our, we've implemented a lot of different strategies to sort of get through those tough times with them. We're currently lambing in confinement, which is, you know, it's been it hasn't been a disaster by no means. It's working quite well. I mean, we're basically down to no other options, but we had to build 12 pens and lock all of our ewes in there, which they're currently lambing in. So that's been a huge strategy that we've implemented to get through the dry. Feedlot and all of our lambs. So we've got them in the, we've got lambs in the feedlot. We've got all our ewes in our confinement, I should say confinement paddocks. They're not such pens. They're sort of 4 to 8 hectare paddocks. We're feeding them every day in those pens. And yeah, they're lambing well. They're going very well, actually. It's been something that's been very challenging for my dad. He's sort of the livestock man. It's what he invests all of his time into. And it's certainly tested him, that's for sure.
Okay. I worked for an agricultural lender, a bank that just lends to farmers. And in Montana, no doubt everybody's heard of Montana, at least. It's our big country, and there's definitely more cows than people. And in my time there, they had a reasonably bad drought, and the make or break for those livestock operations during that drought was if Grandpa was still alive. And the reason that mattered is that Grandpa had been through several droughts. Montana's fairly droughty, not always, but it certainly can be. And it's very common to drive through Montana and see maybe 2 or 3 years worth of feed inventory hay stored as round bales. Their hay storage practices are abysmal. I hope nobody from Montana is taking this too hard. But they had a lot of inventory to manage through droughts. And then if Grandpa was gone, the wisdom was gone, was the implication there. And it was just the young guys that were trying to run thin and hard and fast. They didn't carry near as much feed inventory. Is that going to change for you now?
John, I would say not, no. I mean, we run a huge inventory of feed. We have, you know, grain storage on site. You know, nothing to hold sort of 4,000 or 5,000 ton of grain. We've got hay sheds. So we've had a lot of fodder up our sleeves. And I genuinely thought, John, we would be right. It went beyond the capacity of what we had. But we bought early. We got some extra loads in early, which has helped. And thank God we did, because all the hay and fodder is absolutely depleted throughout our state. Now there's nothing available. We've actually depleted sort of nearly New South Wales and Victoria also. So we're pretty fortunate to have carried the backlog of fodder on our own farm. It certainly pulled us through. I don't think there's any point having any more. We've moved past that economical feeding point now, and we've cut back a lot of livestock. Don't get me wrong, we're back probably 30-35% on our breeders. We've offloaded anything that's obviously not viable to carry. That all happened very quickly. I remember my dad saying to me, he's like, "That's it, boys. That's as low as I go. We'll feed our way out of it." It was an optimistic approach, and we nearly haven't fed our way out of it, John. We've just had enough to get through. So call it good management, call it good luck, call it what you want, but we've been very fortunate to have the amount of fodder we have had, and yeah, just very lucky.
I've heard those stories. Any of the livestock that's knock-kneed, cross-eyed, looks at you funny, takes a run at you unnecessarily, all of those are the first ones to go in a drought.
Definitely. You really have to prioritize, and just anything that's not up to scratch or viable to keep, it's just got to go, and it's got to happen quick. You only want to be feeding higher value animals or prime breeding stock at that. You don't need any more than you need, sort of thing. So,
and then the next cut on that is young stock stays, old stock goes. I mean, you just start working through the list of priorities and hierarchy, right?
Yeah, you do. And you just make small changes along the way, and you might offload a load here and then, you know, go a little bit longer and offload another load. Try and stretch it out. You can't make a radical decisions, you know, but we are just very lucky that we have the capacity in our fodder storage that we've got, John. Like, you know, most people around here don't have that, and it has certainly hurt people, that's for sure. Cost of fodder is just horrendous at the moment, and hopefully this rain just keeps on giving a little bit and we see some release.
Out of curiosity, if you absolutely had to have a load of oat and hay today, what would it cost per ton?
Well, it's a tough one. Depends where it comes from, obviously, John. Freight is just huge. Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing to blow $200 a ton just on freight. But, you know, there was hay coming out of New South Wales, you know. Early on, we were buying stuff around 260 to 280, freighting it back here. That was pretty good going. But basically, most people up around $400 a ton now for hay. And you put the freight onto that, back here landed, you're talking 600 to 650 a ton. And that certainly hurts. I mean, the dairy guys and that, they would be paying that. But, you know, as a sheep producer, it's just well beyond the economics of return.
You have to have a really long-term vision to feed hay at that price.
You do, and you have to determine very quickly what game you're playing. Are you playing the short-term reward game, or are you playing the long game? We always say here, we play the long game every day here. So we overlook a little bit of that stuff. you know, hoping that it'll be all right in the long term. But it doesn't want to go on any longer, that's for sure, John.
A big thanks to our guest today for sharing valuable insights. This podcast is proudly presented by Feed Central and Local Ag. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes.